Call the next case.
Lindsay versus Commonwealth, Elizabeth Toomey, Appellant's Counsel, Robert A. Hansen, the third senior assistant attorney general, Appellee's Counsel.
You may proceed.
May I please report? My name is Elizabeth Toomey. On behalf of the appellant, James Lindsay, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
Jury instruction number 16 violates the due process clause because it contained a mandatory rebuttable presumption that shifted the burden of proof to the defendant. The issue is, could a reasonable juror have understood the instruction as this mandatory presumption that shifts the burden of persuasion to the defendant?
When you say mandatory, you mean the fact finder had no discretion to not accept the presumption as opposed to a pure rebuttable presumption of fact?
Well, mandatory presumptions can be either conclusive or rebuttable. So there are the two different types of mandatory presumptions, but they would both violate due process because it does not give them any discretion in that sense.
Let me ask you a question about this. The word presumption, of course, does not appear in Instruction 16 anywhere.
Correct.
So what you're doing is saying that the inevitable impact of it would lead a juror to believe that it exists either rebuttable or not.
That's correct.
Well, in our case of Hudson versus Commonwealth, we explored this concept that the Commonwealth has the burden of proof, obviously, beyond reasonable doubt. But then there's a corollary to that exists in our case law that says, and they must exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. Now, in the Hudson case, we said, well, it's still out there, and it's still a concept, but it doesn't mean anything more than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it seems to me that Instruction 16, the language, unless there is believable evidence to the contrary, simply embraces the idea of excluding every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. What do you say about that?
Well, obviously there are two parts of the instruction. So the first part is what I believe is the mandatory part, where it says willful concealment is evidence of an intent to defraud.
Well, it is.
Because...
It is. Statute says that.
It does. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the statute is not also unconstitutional, because the statute talks about the prima facie evidence, which
well,
I also...
Can we pause for just 1 second in putting aside the legal theory? How could it not be? People don't go into stores and willfully conceal stuff for reasons that are other than arguably nefarious. It's not that willful concealment proves it beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just admissible evidence. You take it into account. How could it not? I mean, it seems so commonsensical. I'm not even following the initial premise of your argument.
Well, two parts. When the instruction says it's evidence of, I think we as legal scholars interpret that to mean, oh, it's just something for the jurors to consider, just like any other evidence, just like this person's testimony is evidence and this person's testimony is evidence. But I don't believe that's the way that jurors read that instruction. So I believe that when jurors read that instruction, the part which is evidence of, they read that as willful concealment equals the intention.
Well, also, I mean, isn't there a little bit more to it than that? Because it seems like to me in this instance that your argument is that there is a presumption that willful concealment is intent, indicates intent, is evidence of intent.
That's correct.
And although one could say commonsensically, one would believe that's true, I don't know that that necessarily is. I mean, what about an instance where the dad is in the store with his son, he's got a pack of gum in his hand, and his little boy needs him to zip the jacket. He sticks the gum in his pocket, he zips his son's jacket up. I wouldn't presume that he was trying to steal the gum.
Absolutely.
When he takes it right back out of his pocket and he goes up to the counter to pay for it.
I agree with Your Honor. And another example would be, with these cloth bags, because we're so environmental now, that we bring our bags with us when we go to the store and say, I don't have a basket, but I've got two.
See, that's a great example. Because the reason it's a great example is it's not whether it's a presumption. The question is it evidence? But is there believable evidence to the contrary? Because Commonwealth still has the burden to exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. You know, today, right now in grocery stores, they're always encouraging people, I guess for environmental reasons, to bring their own bags. And as soon as they started doing that, I said, oh my goodness gracious, what we're going to have is a whole bunch of cases where people put merchandise in their own bags and it's going to be concealment of goods.
Right.
But every reasonable hypothesis of innocence is still the Commonwealth's burden. So, what, I mean, it's not necessarily a presumption. It is an analysis of what the Commonwealth's burden in its entirety is. It is evidence, you can put it forward, of intent to convert, but the Commonwealth still has the burden of proof to exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence, and there it is.
But
our case law.
But I thought your argument is that the concealment, the instruction presumes that the concealment is intent, as opposed to allowing it to be permissible as to whether or not the juror believes this evidence or whether it is not.
That is exactly right.
Because you could also have this instruction to say that there is a permissible inference that if somebody sticks something in their pocket, it's evidence of their intent to steal it.
Correct.
But our instruction says if they put it in their pocket, you juror, you have to take that as evidence that they were trying to steal something.
Yes.
You don't have a choice. You can't say, well, no, I don't think it is. I mean, I know Don Lemon just because he put it in his pocket. I don't believe that's evidence he was trying to steal it. But this instruction said, no, Bernard, you've got to believe that's evidence he was trying to steal this thing.
We have a statute that's already passed constitutional muster about passing bad checks. And you mail it back to the person who drafted it and tell them it's bad, and they don't fix it within 15 days, it is evidence of intent to defraud.
The thing I don't understand about your argument is, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding you, and the dialogue between us on the bench is highlighting this, it seems to me there's a giant non sequitur on your point, because based upon the last exchange, of course it's evidence. How could it not be evidence? But you say, no, it is necessary proof. They've got to accept it, as Justice Goodwin points out. They don't have a choice. They've got to accept it as evidence of intent. No, they don't. It's simply evidence. You can and there's another instruction that says you can accept or reject any evidence you find credible, incredible, if there's a hypothesis of innocence, etc. So I've yet to find any in the case law that either the two of you have cited any cases that use language like this and says, you know what, in between the lines, they're going to read this as a mandatory, irrebuttable presumption of intent, when it just doesn't say that. What's wrong with my thinking?
That's the problem. But so my thinking is that the jurors read the instruction as willful concealment equals the intent to steal. They don't necessarily understand the distinction of it's evidence just like anything else could be evidence, which is why the word infer is so much more preferable under the constitutional analysis, because you don't get into that. You completely take that out of the equation.
Okay, I get the point. I hear the point. Show me some case law that says that, because the very case that led us down this path, the Supreme Court Ulster County case, not only says that permissible inferences can be drawn from language like this, it even uses the present-day bad word presumption of fact, which historically was not a bad word in terms of due process. It's only become one in recent cutting and pasting of case law. But is there any case that's authoritative, and certainly any case in our line of precedent, that says that if we simply say fact pattern X is evidence of Y, and then other instructions say you can reject it or accept it depending on what you think, that that's a violation of due process?
I have not found any previous instructions that were worded exactly the same way as this one, where X is evidence of Y. Most of the other prior cases either use the bad word presumption or the word inference, which has been held to pass constitutionalism. The problem in this case is that neither of those terms are mentioned.
Are you familiar with the bad check statute?
I haven't necessarily reread it in anticipation, but
It is evidence of intent to defraud. This instruction says that concealment is evidence of an intent to convert or defraud. What is the difference between the two? Because the first one has passed constitutional muster. Why won't the second one?
Well, I haven't reviewed the jury instruction, so I'm not sure if the jury instruction is written in a way that uses the term inference, which would pass the constitutional muster. So the jury instruction, of course, is just really interpreting the statute for the jury. And that's, so it's not necessarily, it's the interpretation of the statute. So I don't know what the jury instruction would be. I haven't, if there's a model, I'm sure there is. I'm not familiar with it. But I would say that prima facie evidence, I think, is the problem here. If it's interpreted in a way that tells the jury that they must do something unless it's rebutted, because when you say you can rebut this, then that's what shifts the burden of persuasion to the defendant. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, mate. Please, the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. Let me, I'm not quite sure where to start, but start off with, counsel just made a reference to the problem, made a reference to prima facie evidence being the problem. I would point out that the instruction that was given does not contain the term prima facie. Now, it's interesting because the statute does. The model jury instruction does not contain the term prima facie, and it noted the notes accompanying the instruction essentially said that, based on some of these cases, such as this court's decision in Hodge, that not keeping the language prima facie in is probably preferable. So, I just noted at the outset, prima facie doesn't show up. Also, words like presume, presumption are not in this statute. Words like must are not in there. And so, in other words, I forget if it's Sandstrom or Francis V. Franklin, but one of them talked about the language being couched in terms of command. We don't have that here. The next thing I would point out, and it's come up to some degree in the argument with opposing counsel, and I would point out that I think at the outset one thing distinguishes this decision from just about any other burden-shifting case that I can think of. There's no question that there are several discrete elements in this crime and in the instruction. And the first one was willful concealment of goods or merchandise while on the premises of the store. The second element is with an intent to convert and defraud. I submit that those two elements, there's a substantial overlap between the two, and it's hard to imagine. If you have willful concealment of goods, it's very hard to understand how you could have anything other than the requisite intent. I would point out, first of all, I think the word concealment is...
Well, Justice Goodwin gave an example.
Well, I was just about to respond to that. Concealment, I think, is suggestive of a certain mindset, other than just, well, while Junior's doing this, I'll stick it in my pocket. But beyond that, willful...
But how do you tell that from the bad? How do you tell the good guy from the bad guy?
Well, the statute, we're concerned with whether the instruction was proper. This says willful concealment of goods. The case law in Virginia makes quite clear that willful is essentially done something done in a bad or corrupt manner, not something done.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Not done something done innocently or absent-mindedly. You cannot have a willful concealment. The examples you gave, I don't think on their face could be characterized as willful concealment.
Why couldn't it not? Why could it not be?
Because the term willful suggests, I can, if you like, I can just quote a couple of
quote a couple
sentences here. Bear with me for one moment.
Well, I would think willful would mean volitionally.
Not according to the cases I cited, Your Honor. Let's see. I used to be faster than this trying to find cases, but...
I think the difference is, as Justice Goodman is saying, if he came up behind me in the store and put a candy bar in my pocket, that would not be willful concealment on my part. That's what he's saying.
No,
he's
but
got to be right about that.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, but the problem is... This is how this court, in a recent case, I think this was one of the felony child abuse cases, Barrett v. Commonwealth, which is pretty recent, it's a 2004 case, quote, the word willful, when used in a criminal statute, generally means an act done with a bad purpose, without justifiable excuse, stubbornly, obstinately, perversely. The word is also employed to characterize a thing done without ground for believing it is lawful. And also a case of the Court of Appeals, Johnson from 35 Virginia Ave. The statute, quote, does not prohibit simply the concealment of merchandise, but rather it prohibits a willful concealment. So we're talking about a very distinct set of cases.
Yeah, but then you infer the intent. I mean, but then the statute infers instruction infers the intent.
My point, Your Honor, is there's no dispute about the fact that the jury appropriately found the willful concealment element beyond a reasonable doubt, that no instruction improperly relieved the Commonwealth of any burden to prove that element. If that's the case...
I'm not worried about proof in this particular case. You understand that, right? We were talking more on a hypothetical level, but go ahead.
My point is, the defendant on brief has not asserted that any of these instructions had the slightest impact on the jury's conclusion that the Commonwealth had proved beyond a reasonable doubt the first element, which is willful concealment. Their only challenge has been the instruction as it relates to the second element, which is this requisite intent.
Right.
So one of my points is, and this goes to the issue of harmless error, it also goes to the rationality of the link between the predicate proven facts and then the fact from which that would give rise to.
The ultimate fact.
The ultimate fact, yes. So if you have, in a constitutionally appropriate way, the finding of willful concealment, which is something in plain English is a concealment that is not done innocently, absent-mindedly, in good faith, if you find this corrupt, bad concealment of...
But remember, I mean, I guess I have a little bit of an issue of, you seem to think that one can discern when somebody puts something in their pocket whether they have intentions of doing it in a bad way or in a positive way.
I'm saying...
I'm just wondering, how do you prove that? How do you show that?
I'm saying that the jury was required to find that there had been a willful concealment. That was what the whole point of the evidence and the instructions was. So the jury had to find that facts amounted to a willful concealment.
And in your mind, the willful concealment is if I put it in my pocket with the intent to take it. That's what makes it willful, according to you.
Well, when you say take it, all I can say is it's if it ends up in someone's on their person, in their clothes, etc., while they're still on the premises, you have two possible explanations for that. One is innocent, along the lines of some that you posited to counsel, and some are not innocent, which is they stick it in their pocket or in their jacket, knowing that they're going to try to get out of there and take it. The jury had to find here that the possession of the goods was a willful concealment. There is no claim or showing that any of these instructions wrongly persuaded the jury to conclude that there was a willful concealment here when there wasn't.
Okay.
You know, I don't understand why you choose to climb a mountain when you could just climb a hill.
Well, I would rather go climb the hill.
Well, what Justice Goodwin, I think, and I don't need to speak for him, he does extremely well by himself.
I'll need all the help I can get. Go ahead.
Willful in this statute could very easily simply mean volitional. I did it. Yeah, I did it. He didn't put it in my pocket, I put it in my pocket. That's willful. Why do you feel like you have to have this connotation of guilt, criminal guilt, associated with willful, particularly when the instruction itself ends with unless there is unbelievable evidence to the contrary?
Well, most of my brief has gone along more, shall we say, traditional lines in terms of defending the instruction, and let me just point out some of them. Again, as I indicated, look at the language of the statute. There's no mandatory language in there. It just simply says that if you have the willful concealment,
it's evidence.
It is evidence.
And the defendant's whole argument is.
It doesn't say it proves something. It doesn't say it proves something unless you do this or that. It just simply says it is evidence. That is about as equivocal and as mild a language as I have seen in these.
Well, let me ask this. If that's true, and if that's what it means, why is there, unless there's believable evidence to the contrary? Why would you need to say that?
Well, I would say.
Of course. That's. Okay. Go ahead.
I know that there are several cases of this court that I've cited on brief, and I frankly don't remember which one, that pointed out it actually inured to the defendant's benefit to have that language in there because it showed that the defendant had the ability to put on evidence and he wouldn't be stuck with some conclusion that was adverse to him.
But don't you have to worry about the fact that you're telling the jurors that unless he puts on evidence, you're putting a burden on him to put on some evidence, to refute that evidence?
I think you have to look at the language of the instruction in its entirety, and frankly, you also have to look at the remainder of the record.
Let me just ask you a question. Can I ask you a direct question? If the first part of the instruction is a permissible inference, right, why do you need the last part? If the instruction is willful concealment, from willful concealment of goods or merchandise while on the premises of a store, you may infer that this is evidence of intent to convert and defraud the owner of the value. Why would you need to say, unless there is believable evidence to the contrary? You could still, even if there's believable evidence to the contrary, you could still think that it was willful intent to convert.
I would make 2 points, Your Honor. First, you have to take the language in its totality. And the first part simply says, is evidence of an intent to convert and defraud. It doesn't say anything more than that. It simply says it's evidence. It doesn't
right.
say it establishes.
Right.
It doesn't say it proves.
Right.
That's the first thing. The second thing, is, and it may be that latter language was unnecessary, but I know I've cited at least one case here on brief that essentially said that similar language at the end, it actually inured to the defendant's benefit because it would... The jury would know that if there was this believable evidence put on, you can't, that basically dissipates the effect of the Commonwealth's evidence, which in other words, it inured to the defendant's benefit. I would also point out that
literally, the last clause, if literally taken, goes even further than that. It says you can't even consider the concealment as evidence at all if there's believable evidence of the contrary.
Right.
But that's wrong. That can't be true, is it?
Well,
they can if they want to. Why would you take that away from them?
Well, it's something that inures to the defendant's benefit. I don't see how he, as the appellant on appeal, benefits from at worst a mistake that was to his.
But let me ask you that. Just answer that question for me. Is that correct? I mean, if you tell somebody this is evidence of XYZ, but if they put on any contrary evidence, you can't believe the evidence that was put
on.
Well,
I would. If I were tasked with the duty of coming up language, I'd probably come up with something a little different. But that's a far cry from concluding that it's an unconstitutional shifting of the burden of proof. I would also point out this court's, hopefully I have time to make 2 quick last points. I would direct this court's attention to the decision of this court in Wilson v. Commonwealth, which was one of these spotlighting cases, and the instruction there was taken verbatim from the statute. So this assertion in the reply brief that we can't really know what the instruction said is incorrect. It tracked, it was taken verbatim from the statute, and the court upheld as permissible inferences two things. One, that if a person at night in possession of certain weapons flashed a light from his vehicle without good cause, it shall raise a presumption of an intent to kill deer or elk in violation of the section. far stronger language than anything in our case. Then it said, every person in any such vehicle shall be deemed a principal in the second degree. Both of those portions of the instruction far stronger than anything here. Finally, I just would point out, I disagree that the test here is whether a reasonable juror could have understood the instructions so as to render them unconstitutional. I would point out the U.S. Supreme Court case in Boyd, which dealt with a variety of cases, including Sandstrom and Francis B. Franklin, and announced a new test, which is whether there was a reasonable probability of a misapplication of instruction.
Do you see any difference between what's being done in this case and what is done in the bad check statute?
No. No, Your Honor. I think they're pretty comparable. I've cited some bad check cases in my on my brief. It's very difficult to see how reversal in this case could be squared with the bad check cases. I think it'd be very hard to square with the Wilson case. It would be very hard to square with the Dobson case about possession of recently stolen goods, raises the inference that the possessor is the thief. And by the way, in that case, they pointed out that the longer the period of time between the date of the theft and the possession, the weaker the inference. In this case, the person is still on the premises.
I think you've answered the question. Thank you very much. Rebuttal. Why don't we start there? Bad check statute says 5 days. I thought it was 15. It's even more onerous than I thought. It's 5 days. You have written notice that the check has not been paid to the holder. Notice mailed by certified registered mail to the last known address shall be deemed sufficient and equivalent to notice having been received. Once notice has been received, it is prima facie evidence of intent to defraud. What's the difference between the bad check statute and this model jury instruction?
I think they both use the prima facie evidence improperly, because prima facie evidence, of course, means that it's presumed unless evidence is offered to rebut it, which shifts the burden to the defendant. I'm not sure the case that you're referencing, I'm not familiar with, so I apologize.
We've had the statute before us with the argument that you make, and we've rejected it. So what you're saying is that if you're right with the case before us, the bad check cases have to go too.
As long as the jury instruction is also interpreted as a mandatory.
Well, how are you going to? I mean, suppose we had a jury instruction that is word for word the statute. How do you get that interpreted? It's a statement of the law.
Well, I think as long as prima facie is properly defined, which is my understanding that it's defined as essentially presumed evidence, unless somebody brings up additional evidence to rebut it.
Actually,
it's
more complicated than that. Prima facie has two different meanings. And the U.S. Supreme Court has recently addressed this, as did the Court of Appeals a couple of years ago. It can mean what you're saying, which is a preponderance is presumed subject to rebuttal. But it also can mean simply sufficiency. A prima facie case, and this is what it means in any motion to strike, it's not that you must presume it, or we're telling you to presume it. We're saying you could find these facts if you chose to find these facts based upon this record. It's a prima facie showing, facial showing. But that doesn't mean the fact buyer is presumed to find it or told to find it or the thumbs on the scale or any of that.
Which is why if the jury instruction says you may infer, then I think it passes constitutional muster. As long as we use that word infer, I think it's very clear that that passes constitutional muster. I think that just needs to be clear. With respect to the Wilson case, I just wanted to make a point. Wilson was decided before Francis versus Franklin. And, of course, Francis versus Franklin is the case that I am relying most heavily on in my brief. I think did substantially change the landscape of the presumption versus inference and burden shifting aspect of it. So to that extent, I do believe that Wilson would be essentially overruled.
The Commonwealth says that if there's any problem with this instruction, it actually favors the defendant. What do you say?
I agree with Justice Goodwin in that respect, because I believe that once we state, unless there's believable evidence to the contrary, that undermines what you had previously said, if your interpretation is, well, it's just evidence, it's just one thing to consider, then why do you need to say there's believable evidence? Plus, when you say believable evidence, meaning that the defendant has to be believable, you're suggesting the defendant is somehow not believable.
But it doesn't say the defendant puts on the evidence. The defendant doesn't have to put on any evidence. The believable evidence can be the very circumstances of the alleged concealment. So concealment is evidence, but if the evidence is he's concealing it for a millisecond to pick up his child who fell on the ground, then there's believable evidence that immediately bursts the bubble of the inference and it's gone without the defendant putting on any evidence.
Well, the jury instruction in Francis versus Franklin, of course, didn't say the defendant needed to put on evidence either, and that was struck down. It just said that it could be rebutted.
The first predicate was mandatory, whereas ours is not.
Well, I would disagree with that last time.
Well, now you jump on believable, but I mean the word that we use in the cases is reasonable, a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. So if the hypothesis of innocence is that I was in the supermarket and a giant condor came swooped down and took a box of cereal and put it in my purse, it's not reasonable. It's also not believable. So it's not a question of the difference between the word believable or reasonable. It is the question of whether or not, first, there's a presumption in the outset. I don't see it. And the second is whether the last phrase of the jury instruction itself actually comports with prior case law that we have about reasonable hypotheses of innocence. It seems to me that believable isn't the problem. It's the hypothesis of innocence that they have to consider before they can find him guilty, or it's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think the big problem is that it's the burden shifting aspect of it is the real question.
Say that again.
The burden shifting aspect of that last part of the instruction that is the problem. So when you say unless there's believable evidence to the contrary, that's what shifts the burden to the defendant.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think what you're saying is that when the burden is stated as on the Commonwealth to exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence, that the locus of the issue is there on the Commonwealth, and in this instruction, the locus of the issue is on the defendant.
I agree with that.
Well, it's not entirely on the defendant. It doesn't say it's on the defendant. It just says that there's evidence to the contrary.
But neither did the instruction in Francis versus Franklin did not say, but the defendant can rebut it. It just says it may be rebutted, and was also struck.
And then the point that was made, I think was in Franklin by the Supreme Court, is that when you have language such as this, a reasonable jury would believe that it would be the defendant that would put on that evidence. Because why would the prosecution put on evidence, a believable evidence to the contrary, when they're trying to convict the defendant?
That's exactly what I believe Francis held.
All right, very spirited argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case.